television at that stage might have been a little bit like when the internet first came out. It would have been a new thing.
Oh, I think it was very much an unknown thing. People just did not know about television. They had absolutely no idea that it was going to be something important in their lives. Of course, most people didn't have a set. And they only found out that they really quite liked this new thing when they saw it perhaps in the street, in a shop window, where the other people would gather and people would stand and watch fascinated.
When was the first time you saw a television set?
The first time I saw it, oddly enough, was in England in 1951 or 52. I was there for a year. And I visited some friends of friends, and they had television. Oh, this was... And there was a play on... a BBC play, and I thought, how absolutely wonderful. Because I've always been interested in theatre, and in fact involved in theatre, and I thought, oh, wouldn't it be fantastic to be in or involved with something like that.
And so at that stage, your work with the ABC was about ABC radio, I suppose.
Yes.
When did you first hear that there were going to be plans to do a television coverage of the 56 Olympics?
Well, it was, of course, just about the same time as television was going to start live out of Melbourne. And I was working for ABC Radio, and they were looking for likely men and women to train as television staff. And I was one of those who was chosen, because I had this theatrical background, to become what was called a script assistant. Later was called a production assistant. Men were chosen as producers, of course, and women were relegated to being assistants. That was the way the world was. But I was absolutely delighted to be chosen. And so we did our television training, 2 weeks of it in Sydney. And that was when it was all being talked about, the start of television and the fact that we would be working out of the Melbourne studios and the fact that the Olympic Games were going to be held in Melbourne, all at the same time, very much.
How many of you would have had a television at home?
Nobody. Nobody. We had not seen television, nor, I suspect, had the people who were training us. It was the blind leading the blind, believe me, for a fortnight. We all had a lot of fun, but nobody knew anything. We learnt on the job.
And the Olympic Games is quite a job to learn on.
Yes, it was. There were very few of us, because we worked as teams of producer and script assistant, and you were either rostered on for the... for the daytime activities or the nighttime in the swimming pool or whatever. You just had to do it. You got on with it. You pointed a camera, you directed, you know, if you were the producer, you had your cameras in the pool or wherever they were, all set up by the technical crew, and you got on with it. Television had started in Melbourne in about August, I think it was, and we didn't have any proper studios, nothing was built yet. So we used to work from the outside broadcast van as the control room, from wherever, a hall or somewhere like that, which was big enough to accommodate whatever we wanted to do. And so that the opening night was done from a hall in Melbourne, in Prahran, with the van parked outside, with the technical crew and the production crew all crammed inside.
And then you only really got that a couple of months more before the game started.
That's right.
What was the feeling like amongst the crew on that very first day for the opening ceremony?
I think we were all beyond feeling anything. I really think we were all numb. It was just a matter of getting out there and doing it. I think there was so much nervous tension, it was probably explosive. But it didn't ever... Nobody threw the spark, so nobody exploded, and we just didn't feel anything very much. We were numb until it was all over. Then there was the next day. We had to front up and do it all again. Everything was live. Nothing was pre-recorded. So, yes, whatever you were doing was going to air. You had your monitors there for each of the cameras, and you could direct those cameras. And, of course, the script assistant, that was the job I was doing, because of the confinement of the van, not too many people could sit in there, so you couldn't have a vision mixer to cut between the cameras. So that became my job. So apart from watching the producer, watching what was going to come up next, stopping him doing anything particularly stupid, and keeping him on the rails. You had to do all the cutting between cameras, all the fades, all the blackouts. You had to learn. I mean, you literally had to be able to take over if your producer suddenly dropped dead. Well, you didn't have any choice. It was the script assistant who moved into his chair and took over. So you had to learn very fast how to handle this situation.
Was it as organised as that, or were you really winging the process as you and
evolving?
Totally
winging everything. Nothing was organised. I have never seen anything in such a state of disorganisation, only because we didn't know. We made it up on the spot. And we got through it. I mean, I'm quite sure that what we put out allowed people to see and hear exactly what was going on very well. We gave them a good coverage. Why not?
It must have been a wonderful close-up view of the games, a great experience of an event like
that. Oh, it was spectacular. Yeah, I mean, I did see an awful lot. On those rare occasions when you were not working, we were always issued with a pass which had the date written on them by pen, ballpoint pen, and somebody found some mouthwash or something that took that off very nicely, so we were able to write a new date on it and give those old ones to all of our friends, so they were all seeing the games free. And there was no security at the MCG or anywhere like that. You just wandered around. If you found an empty seat, you sat down in it, even if you didn't have a ticket. But I can remember, you know, when I was not working, for instance, going along to the pool at night. And the cameras were mounted on a platform which was high above the finishing line, and there was a ladder up to it, and the camera boys would give me a bit of a hand up, and up I would go, and I would sit there on this platform swinging my legs above the pool with a fantastic view.
How old were you at that time?
How old was I? I was 30. I was old. I was the oldest of all the script assistants. I only just scraped in. I think they liked to still all be young girls. But I was 30 at that time, because it's a long time ago, and I'm now very nearly 83.
Did you get up to the museum at all to see the old van?
Oh, yes, indeed I did. Yes, that was quite a moving experience. I went up to Canberra not long after my husband died, not that long ago, and I think I was feeling pretty elderly, frail, and I wanted to prove to myself that I could get on with the rest of my life, so I went up to Canberra and I thought, I'll just do a few things that I'd like to do, and I haven't seen the new museum. So I went along there, and I was up on about the second floor, and I looked down. It was a large open space where you could look down to the floor below, and there below me was the van. And I was staggered. I thought, my dear old OB van, there it is. So I raced down to the floor below, and I desperately wanted to get in it. I could see my seat there that I'd sat in for years. And, no, madam, you must not go past the... And I said, oh, please, that was my van. I sat in it for years. No, I'm sorry, you cannot. So I thought, oh, dear. So I said, well, look, I'll tell you what I am going to do. I'm going to lean over and I'm going to just pat the van. So the man seemed a little doubtful about this, but he let me do it. And I leaned over and I patted the van and I said, there, there, van, I'm back. And the van positively purred. I could hear him purring. And then I burst into floods of tears because I was so emotional about the whole thing. It was a rather pathetic story, but I did enjoy seeing the van again.
Good for you. Well, you're going to have to get back up there, and we'll make sure that you get in there.
Yeah, that would be nice. Yes, yes, we could just be old friends again. No tears this time. Hello, van, I'm back. I think there was so much emotion bottled up in that van, the nervous tension we didn't know we had, that she just tapped into it again by even seeing it. Extraordinary.
So where did you go to with your career after that?
Well, I continued as a script assistant for 3 years before I was invited to become a producer. It came totally out of the blue. I was the first woman in Australia to be a producer. And this absolutely astounded me. I just got one of the little ABC memos that came around, you know, regularly, dropped on my desk and told me that I had been appointed. Just like that. Took my breath away. took my producer's breath away too, I can tell you. But because, as I say, no other woman had been appointed before, and it fell my way in 1959, 3 years after we started.
That's a very significant achievement.
It is. It's lovely to be able to say that, yes. I think one of my first things was to go to Pentridge, and they wouldn't let me in. Pentridge Jail. Why we were doing a program from Pentridge Jail, I really can't remember now. But we were. But being a woman, I wasn't allowed in, and so I had to just direct the whole thing from the van without ever having seen anybody inside. Oh, it was a curious world in those days. For the first, not very long, first 6 months or so, I was in the pool, which meant you did anything that came your way. You were just allotted programs, which could be anything from a variety show to a talk show to a cooking show to anything. But then they decided, and this really interested me, that the children's program, which up till then had been done every day from Sydney, would go local one day a week, and that Melbourne and Brisbane, I think, were to be allowed to do their own children's program on Thursday. It was to be called Partyland, and I was to produce it. And I would go up to Sydney, and I would see what they did with their Partyland, and I would come down and do something similar, which I did, and I came back and I did something quite dissimilar, which was absolutely a joy. I had just so much response to that program. It used to be booked out a year in advance. We had 200 children live in the studio. We had two compares, various variety acts, a birthday party, but star of the whole thing was the ultimate joy of my life, and that was Hamlet. And Hamlet was our pig mascot, live on the studio floor with the kids adoring him. And Hamlet was just an absolute wonder. The press coverage that he got, the papers loved him. Hamlet got cutting after cutting after cutting, which filled my scrapbook. He grew from a little piglet who was, I think, 6 weeks old on the first program, and I said, oh, isn't he sweet? I had asked the props department to find me a little pig. It was because I knew I wanted a little animal, as the children's mascot, and I happened to like pigs. So I thought, I don't want anything ordinary like a dog or a cat or a bird or something. Let's have a little pig. So they got me a little pig, and I could hold him in my two hands. I have a photograph of that. Because he was Hamlet, he had, of course, his own trailer which went out to the farm where he used to live. The trailer was attached to the back of the props van, but it was mocked up as a castle, with, of course, Elsinore across the gate. And there was a let-down gate on chains, and this would be brought into the studio with all of this facing the camera. And on cue, music cue, a little fanfare, we would play Hamlet's fanfare, the drawbridge would come down, and out he would trot onto the studio floor, never, ever failed. He never missed a beat, that pig. And he adored the children, and the children adored him. They stuffed him full of really awful cream cakes and things that you should not give to pigs, and he loved it. And he grew. He turned out to be a large white, and Hamlet got bigger and bigger until he was almost dangerous to himself. He was tottering around on these little, how pigs have little feet with high-heeled shoes, and he was sort of slipping on the studio floor. My husband became terrified. He said, one of these days Hamlet is going to fall over, he's going to break a leg or do something terrible, and you're going to be in the most terrible strife. He said, you have got to retire Hamlet. Well, Julian convinced me. I could see what he was saying. Hamlet did, though, last, and he was the ultimate star for 3 years. And then he retired to the zoo.
What was Hamlet's life like at the zoo?
Oh, well, when he went to the zoo, I rang her to say, I've got to retire Hamlet, would you like him? She said, oh, we'd love him, he'd be a terrific draw card. Yes, please, give me Hamlet. So, okay, Hamlet went to the zoo, that's another story in itself. But when he got there, I had a phone call the next morning, and she said, Hamlet is sulking. He will not come out of his cage or room or whatever he was in. He will not come out the front. The children are all coming here asking for Hamlet, and I cannot get him to come out. I said, no worries, I will send you his fanfare. I said, you play that fanfare where he can hear it, and he'll come out. And he did. Never missed a trick. I'm on. You know, he was the star.
Did the show go on without Hamlet?
We went on without him. We had other not-so-joyous animals that followed him. He was followed by, well, he was followed by Ophelia, of course, but Ophelia was a goat. And goats do not have the same charm as large white pigs do. I mean, look at that.
Good heavens.
That's 6 weeks old on the first program. That's my two hands holding him. And that's how he was 3 years later.
Yeah, well, he certainly ate like a pig.
Oh, he was lovely. Oh, he was such a nice pig. He would do anything you asked him. He was such a... and so intelligent. And didn't like being pushed around by the props boys. You had to speak to him nicely and say, come on, Hamlet, we're going for a walk. And he'd trot along beside you, no problem.
Thanks, Peggy.
My great pleasure, Bill.